Thank you very much, Paul, and good afternoon to you all. It's a pleasure for me to be here this afternoon. As you all know, the last 18 months has been an extremely challenging period. Late last year, we saw risk aversion sweep around the world, global capital markets virtually shut down, confidence in many financial institutions was shaken to its core, global industrial production collapsed, and so did the value of world trade. The result of all this, as you all know, was the worst global downturn since the early 1930s. Yet despite what has been an incredibly difficult international backdrop, the Australian economy has been surprisingly resilient. Amongst the major developed countries of the world, Australia is the only one that has not recorded a negative year-end growth rate during the global downturn. And somewhat remarkably, it's also the only one that has not recorded a drop in its export volumes over the past year. Now, there are a number of reasons for this relatively good performance, and I think they're now pretty well understood. The timely and large adjustments to both monetary and fiscal policy have been important. So too is the healthy state of our banking system. The depreciation we saw over the second half of last year was also important. And last, but certainly not least, has been Australia's trade links with Asia, and in particular, China. They've been very important. But rather than go over this ground again today, I'd like to lift my gaze a bit beyond the current immediate outlook for both the economy and interest rates, to focus on a medium-term structural issue. While it's always a bit treacherous doing that, given the very large uncertainties involved, I think it's important that we periodically do that if we are to appropriately plan for the future. And my central theme is that there are reasonable grounds for considerable optimism about the prospects for the Australian economy over the decade ahead. There are a number of reasons for this, but the one that I would like to focus on today is our growing trade links with Asia. Over the past decade, there's been a very significant shift in economic weight from the advanced economies of the world on the one hand to the emerging world on the other, and particularly those in Asia. This shift has picked up recently, with many of the advanced economies weighed down by problems in the financial system. But more importantly for Australia, this shift has much, much further to run, and it's likely to have profound effects on our prospects and on the structure of our economy. And in my time today, I'd like to talk about some of the changes that we are seeing, and I think we will see. Before I do that, though, I'd like to just begin with a few facts and figures. As you can see from this first chart, if we go back to 1990, the economies of East Asia, excluding Japan, accounted for around 7% of global GDP at market exchange rates. Less than two decades later, the figures more than doubled to 15%. Over those two decades, East Asia has grown at an average rate of 7% a year, compared to just 2% a year for the G7 countries as a group. As you know, growth has been strongest in China. And you can see here the level of Chinese real GDP has increased by almost sixfold since 1990. India has also recorded very strong growth, particularly over recent years. The level of Indian real GDP has tripled since 1990. By comparison, European and US real GDP have only increased by around 50% over these same period. If you look at the figures for industrial production, they're starker still, particularly for China. In 1990, China accounted for just 2% of global industrial production. Today, the figure is 13%, and it's growing still. Industrial production has also expanded very quickly in India. Growth has averaged 8% over the past few years. I think another illustration of the change that's going on is car sales. Over recent months, the number of cars sold in China has been very similar to the number sold in the United States. If you go back a decade ago, for every 100 cars that were sold in China, that were sold in the United States, only 10 were sold in China. Similarly, Indian car sales have been growing extremely strongly, and they've trebled over the past 8 years. Global steel production provides another example, as you can see from this next chart. China currently accounts for almost 50% of the global output of steel. A decade ago, that number was just 15%. I think the general picture here is pretty clear. There's been tremendous growth in Asia, and the economies of the region now account for a significant share of global output. And if you look forward, I think there's a high probability that this growth will continue. As an illustration of this shift in the world economy, the IMF recently put out projections of fixed asset investment in the world. And as you can see from this next chart, by 2014, the IMF is forecasting the total amount of fixed asset investment in the developing world, much of this will occur in Asia, will be the same amount as the amount of investment in the advanced economies. This is a remarkable change from the situation a decade ago, when the level of investment in the developing world was only one-third of that in the developed world. This very large change reflects the subdued prospects for investment in many of the advanced economies. It reflects the high pace of growth in Asia and the current very high rates of investment in many of the countries of Asia. Again, as we look forward, a central question is whether strong growth in Asia can continue in the face of what looks like will be quite weak growth in the developed economies. I think the reasons for this weak growth in the advanced economies are now well understood. The household sectors in these countries are facing significant balance sheet adjustments. There are difficulties in the financial sector, which continue to weigh on the availability and pricing of credit. And many governments in the advanced economies need to take significant steps to put their fiscal positions on a much sounder footing. This next chart provides a good illustration of the challenges here. As you can see, the ratio of aggregate net public sector debt to GDP for the G7 countries is likely to exceed 90% within a few years, an outcome that we have not previously seen outside periods of war. And this increase comes at a time when many governments already faced very serious medium-term fiscal challenges due to the ageing of the population. The combined effect of these public sector debt issues, together with the private sector balance sheet issues, are likely to weigh on prospects for the advanced economies for some time. Now, one school of thought is that if growth is indeed weak in the advanced economies, then growth in Asia will also inevitably be weak, particularly given the role that US consumers are often credited with a driver of growth in the region. Undoubtedly, there's an element of truth here. Slower growth in the advanced economies will weigh on growth in Asia. The business cycles of the major regions of the world are clearly interconnected, and the ups and downs in one part of the world clearly have an impact on the other part of the world. But for us, I think that's not the end of the story. These interconnections do not mean that Asia must inevitably experience a marked reduction in its medium-term growth trajectory. As we've seen recently, the region does have the capability to grow strongly through domestic rather than external demand. In a sense, this really shouldn't come as a surprise to us. After all, if you look at the US economy, with a few hundred million people, it grew for many decades on the back of domestic rather than foreign demand. there's no reason at all that the approximately 3.5 billion people in Asia cannot do the same. It ultimately comes down to the policy choices that are made by their governments. And here there's a reasonably broad consensus as to the type of policy steps that could be taken over the medium term. One possibility is continuing liberalisation of the services sector, which in many of these countries has the potential to grow very strongly over the years ahead. Another is reform of retirement incomes policies to give people more confidence that they have sufficient income in their old age. And a third possibility is development of the financial services sector so that savings can be efficiently allocated to those who can make best use of them. Now, these are all rather long-term structural issues, but progress on each of these fronts can help form the basis for sustainable growth in domestic demand over the medium term for many of the countries in the region. There's also considerable scope for high levels of infrastructure investment in many of these countries, and the process of technology convergence has much further to run, and many of the countries of Asia are devoting significant resources to improve the average quality, the average productivity of their workforces. Of course, none of this means that strong growth in Asia is assured or that the process will be a smooth one. No doubt there will be bumps along the way and there'll be periodic setbacks, and perhaps some of these will be significant. But over the medium term, there is a considerable basis for optimism about growth prospects in Asia, particularly as the economies of the region reorientate towards domestic demand and away from foreign demand. So I'd now like to turn to some of the implications of all this for Australia. I really want to focus on four issues, four areas where we've already seen quite large changes. They are the structure of our international trade, the prices at which we're able to sell our exports, the level of investment in Australia, and the rate of our population growth. Perhaps nowhere is the effect of what's going on in the countries to our north most clear. The area where it's most clear is international trade, especially on the export side. As this next chart shows, the recent trade data from Australia show that Australia's four most important merchandise export destinations over the past year have been China, Japan, South Korea, and India, all obviously in Asia. The fifth largest has been the United States. If you go back just 6 years ago, the US was our second largest export destination. But it was first overtaken by China, then South Korea, and then just very recently by India. Collectively, these four large Asian trading partners accounted for around 55% of our total exports of goods over the past 12 months. If you add in the rest of Asia, the figure's closer to 70%. In this global downturn, we've benefited significantly from this reorientation of our exports towards Asia. Despite global trade falling by 20% over the past year, the volume of Australia's exports have been broadly flat over this period. The strong recovery in China saw demand for raw materials rebound very strongly, and Australian producers were able to respond quickly to this. A number of other commodity exporting countries, whose major customers are in Europe and North America, have on balance had less favourable experiences than we've had. There have also been very large changes in the structure of our imports. Back in 1990, one third of our imports came from Asia. Today, around one half of them come from Asia. Again, a very big change. A second area where you can see the impact of Asia is on our terms of trade. It's the prices we pay for our exports relative to the prices we pay for our imports. Recently, there's been quite a deal of attention paid to the fact that commodity prices have fallen significantly from their peaks of last year. However, in focusing on that, I think we shouldn't lose sight of what I think is the more important point, and that is that Australia's terms of trade remain at very high levels, and you can see this in this next chart here. Currently, the terms of trade are around 50% higher than the average level of the decades of the 1980s and the 1990s. In fact, apart from the past couple of years, the only other period when they've been as high as they are now was a very brief period in the early 1950s when the Korean War led to a spike in wool prices. Now, this improvement in our terms of trade would certainly come as a surprise to many of the commentators of earlier decades who thought that the prices of our exports would inexorably fall relative to the price of our imports. It's also come as a surprise to many contemporary observers. A year or so ago, if you'd known that global industrial production would decline by 15% and the world economy would experience its worst recession since the 1930s, I think few of us would have predicted that global commodity prices would hold up at current levels. There are no doubt a variety of reasons for why this has occurred, but the strong recovery in Asia, particularly that in China, must surely be near the top of the list of explanations. The third area that I'd like to touch on is investment. By the standards of other developed economies, Australia is a high investment country. Over the past year, private sector business investment was the equivalent of 17% of GDP, which, as you can see from this chart, is the highest on record. If you look at total investment, so take both private and public investment, that's also been very high. The result of this is that the capital stock in Australia is currently estimated to be increasing at its fastest rate in several decades. Again, this is a very strong outcome in the middle of a severe global downturn. Not surprisingly, given the demand for commodities, the strength in investment is most noticeable in the resources sector, which you can see in this next chart. According to estimates produced by the ABS, mining investment was the equivalent of 5% of GDP over the past year, which, as you can see here, is a record by a large margin. We had booms in mining investment in the late 1960s and the early 1980s, but these now look comparatively small compared with the current one. Over the past couple of years, we've had particularly high rates of investment in the iron ore and coal industries, and you can now start to see this showing up in export volumes. For example, the volume of iron ore exports has risen by around a third over the past couple of years as new mine and port capacities come on stream, and I think we're going to see further increases over the next little while. I think it's quite plausible that very high levels of investment in the resources sector will continue for some time. In particular, the outlook for LNG appears to be very, very positive. There are a number of large projects that have just started or that are on the drawing board. There's been significant discovery of gas reserves, and the mining companies are signing long-term contracts with customers in Asia. And given the sheer magnitude of these projects, they certainly have the potential to have a very significant impact on the future investment profile for the country. Again, there are a number of reasons for why we've seen this strong investment. Political stability is obviously important, so too a sound macro management and a solid record of microeconomic reform. These were all part of the equation here. But so too are developments in Asia, with the rapid growth in the region generating very strong demand for commodities. Australia is a reliable supplier of many of these commodities, and in many cases it's a low-cost producer. We also benefit from our geographical proximity to the major markets of the region, which means transportation costs are lower. The end result of all this is that both Australian and international firms have been prepared to devote very significant sums of money to develop Australia's resource base, and it seems likely that this will continue for the foreseeable future. The final area that I'd like to draw your attention to is population growth. Over the past year, the ABS estimates that the Australian population increased by 2.1%. As you can see, this is the fastest rate since the mid-1960s, and it's 0.75 percentage point faster than the average growth for the past 20 years. Again, this is in stark contrast to what's happening in almost every other developed economy. If you take the G7 group of countries as a whole, population growth has averaged around 0.5% over recent years, and it's trending down, not up. Again, there are a variety of reasons for why Australia has experienced this increase in its population growth. But I venture to suggest that it is not completely independent of what is happening in the countries to our north. The Australian economy has performed well over recent years, partly because of developments in Asia, and more workers have been needed to meet the growing demand for labour and to reduce the bottlenecks in the economy. The result of this has been a pickup in immigration, and this has boosted population growth, as I said, to the fastest rate in a number of decades. So to summarise here, over recent change, we've seen a very marked change in the structure of our exports. We've seen significant rises in the prices at which we can sell those exports. We've seen historically high rates of investment in this country. And the population is growing at the fastest rate in around 40 years. In one way or another, I think each of these developments can be linked to what is going on in the countries to our north. As a result, Australia's medium-term economic prospects are now more closely linked with Asia than they have ever been before. This also means that business cycle fluctuations in Australia are likely to be more influenced by the dynamics of the Asian business cycle than has been the case in the past. Despite this, I suspect most of us still better understand what's going on in the 50 states of the United States of America than the 30-plus provinces and administrative regions of China or the 28 states and 7 union territories of India. Over time, surely this will change. I know at the Reserve Bank how much more effort we are putting into understanding what is going on in the Asian region. And I'm sure many of you in this room have also moved in the same general direction. As we look beyond the challenges of the global recession, I think if one is optimistic about the medium-term prospects for growth in Asia, as I am, then there are reasonable grounds to be optimistic about the medium-term prospects for the Australian economy. While there's still much uncertainty about how the world economy will evolve over the coming years, Australia finds itself in a much, much better position than most of the other developed economies. This reflects not only our record of sound macro management and the structural reforms that have been undertaken for a number of decades, but also our considerable endowment of natural resources. None of this, of course, means that success is assured, even if the economies to our north grow strongly over the years ahead. The policy choices that we make clearly matter, and there are risks, perhaps significant risks, to be managed here. We need to ensure that our economy remains flexible so that labour and capital can move to where they're most useful. But as we make use of our comparative advantage, we also need to manage the risks that can come from fluctuations in commodity prices and the relatively large cyclical fluctuations of some of our Asian trading partners. We need to keep the focus on removing impediments to capacity expansion so that we can grow strongly without causing inflation. And we need to find ways of housing our rapidly growing population and dealing with the environmental issues that can come with growth. Now, these are all very real challenges, and they will continue to require very hard work if they're to be met over the years ahead. But they are surely better challenges to face than those confronting most of the other advanced economies of the world at the moment. Thank you very much for your time.
I might just take the opportunity to ask one question. Just on Asia and those figures that you gave on the share of trade to Asia is just really striking. And I'm just wondering, just from a point of view of all investors here who sort of know the first principle of investing is diversifying your risk, I'm just sort of wondering, you know, those figures, they're so high in terms of trade shares and our increasing reliance on Asia, do you see some risk that we're becoming too reliant on Asia, or do you think there's enough stabilisers in the economy through the exchange rate, interest rates and the policy flexibility you've talked about to overcome that?
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. I think there are two observations I would make here. One is Asia is not a homogeneous group of countries. I mean, we've seen just recently when the demand for our iron ore and coal from both Japan and South Korea fell away a long way as industrial production in those countries declined. Demand from China replaced that. So the collective demand for our natural resources actually has risen through that period because the different countries in Asia have performed quite differently, and I think that's the world we're going to live in. The second observation I'd make is flexibility of the economy is incredibly important here. I mean, nobody knows what the future is going to hold. But what we do know from the past is that whatever we get, whatever the outcome in the developed countries and the countries of Asia is, the economy is going to respond best to that if we have flexibility in the economy. If we have flexibility in the exchange rate, if we have flexibility in the labour market, if we have flexibility in the allocation of capital in the economy. So flexibility is key, and the group, the Asian countries as a group are not a homogeneous group.
Dr. Lowe, Phil Lasker from the ABC. You're talking about flexibility in a number of things, including the exchange rate. It seems to me everything you've been saying today does suggest we're going to have to live with a relatively stronger Australian dollar than we have over the past decade. The next decade will mean we'll have to live with a relatively stronger Australian dollar. Is that the case? And what would you be telling me now if I was a farmer or someone who worked in the tourism industry or someone who was in our manufacturing industry? Should I be concerned?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to comment on the outlook for the currency, but what I can say is that a country with a high return on capital, which Australia is, will have a higher exchange rate than a country with a low return on capital. And we've become a country with a high return on capital with a lot of investments. So that means I think we will have a higher average exchange rate than we've had over the past couple of decades. Where it goes relative to the current level, though, I'm not going to comment. One of the reasons we need a high real exchange rate is that helps with the resource transfer within the economy. We will only have a high real exchange rate if other parts of the economy are doing well. So, and that will drag the strongly growing parts of the economy will drag resources from elsewhere. And we need to have that as part of the adjustment in this economy.
Dr. Lowe, given our exposure to Asia, do you think that the long-run growth profile of the Australian economy has lifted? And secondly, then, if so, what implication would that have for what we term the neutral interest rate?
That's a very good question, and I wish I knew the answer to it. There are various things going on at the moment. as I said, the outlook for the advanced economies is quite weak. And many people think that that will drag down trend productivity growth in the world economy. And we will no doubt be affected by that if that occurs. We're seeing developments in the financial sector, which mean that the cost of financial intermediation will inevitably be higher than it was over the past couple of decades. And all else constant, that pushes down trend growth in the economy. On the other hand, as I said, we're benefiting from the growth of Asia, and Australia has a very high return on capital, and that's going to push up the trend growth of the economy, particularly if the population growth stays where it is. So you've got forces working in both directions at the moment, and I think it's too early to call which set of forces is going to win out here.
Last question at the back.
Dr. Lowe, it's Sue Lannan from ABC Radio Current Affairs. Last week, the Governor spoke about how you make decisions on monetary policy. He mentioned that the Board is no rubber stamp. So can you shed some light on how the Board came to its most recent decision on interest rates? Were there any dissenters?
What I can talk about is the general strategy the Board has really followed over the last year or so. We saw, particularly after the failure of Lehman Brothers, as I said at the beginning of my talk, a very large increase in risk aversion sweep around the world, and global trade and industrial production collapsed. And given that, the Board thought it was entirely appropriate to reduce interest rates quite quickly, and by more than 4 percentage points over a very short period of time. And that was clearly the right thing to do, and I think the community generally accepts that was the right thing to do. But as the outlook has brightened, as we have benefited from what's been going on in the countries to our north, the Board has for some months signalled that it would be appropriate at some point to start removing some of this considerable stimulus that's been in place. And that's really the process that's now currently underway. The Australian economy has turned out to be quite a lot stronger than we had thought. The countries in Asia, particularly China, have turned out to be stronger than we had thought. And as that reassessment has occurred, the Board had signalled at least a couple of months ago that was going to gradually lead to a more normalisation of interest rates. And that's the process we're now going through.
If I could just ask a quick follow-up. But there were criticisms, particularly from major business groups, that you acted too quickly and you should have waited before you moved on interest rates. What do you say to those criticisms?
There are always criticisms when interest rates are moved up, and actually there were criticisms on the way down by some groups of people as well. I think the key point here is that the setting of interest rates that we've had was put in place at a time when there were very serious people, respectable people, who were arguing that the world economy could be going back to a situation like the 1930s. Earlier this year, global trade was collapsing right around the world. Financial institutions weren't lending. Industrial production was falling at a very rapid rate. That's not the world we're in now. It's quite a different world to the world in which that set of interest rates was put in place. There are certainly still risks out there, and there are certainly uncertainties, but not the same risks and not the same uncertainties that were there in the March quarter of this year. And as those risks and those uncertainties have diminished, it's entirely appropriate that we go back to a more normal setting of monetary policy. The setting that was needed in March is not the setting that was needed in October. And that's the process that's underway now.
Josh Williamson.
Thank you. Dr. Lowe, you've showed us a number of charts that show increasing or decoupling in a trade link sense with the US and greater integration with Asia. You've also mentioned that Australia offers a very good return to capital. With the terms of trade seemingly plateauing at such a strong level, and we've got Chinese growth strengthening again, it would appear then, based on what you've said and what you've presented today, that Australia will be looking towards more capital account surpluses going forward, which applies, of course, current account deficits. Is it a case now that potentially the investment market or people in the economic community need to now sort of get away from pure metrics of current accounts being bad or good in relation to their size and start thinking about the composition of what those deficits are actually funded for?
Well, I think that is a very good question, because with high rates of investment typically come high current account deficits. And I think that's probably the world we're likely to live in over the next few years, because the level of investment in Australia is likely to remain very high. And we don't have the domestic savings to fund that investment. So that means I think we're going to have relatively high current account deficits. But those current account deficits are funding capital, particularly in the mining sector. So we're going to see a change, I think, in the structure of the current account deficit towards more foreign direct investment by the large mining companies and less reliance on bank debt. I think that's probably a healthy change. But people, I think, will need to get used to Australia again having high current account deficits. And that will not be a bad thing. Those current account deficits will reflect the high level of investment in this country. But I think we need to start thinking about how that's going to play out in investors and people who won't worry about country credit risk. Because there are a group of investors, a group of analysts, who think that high current account deficits are necessarily bad. I'm certainly not one of those, particularly if the investment is in physical capital, which one expects will have a high rate of return over the medium term.
Earlier today, Phil, we had John Simons from the Aussie Group here, and he sort of talked about some concerns he had about the first home buyers. Then you recall the big increase in the proportion of lending that went into first-home buyers with the boost to the grant and the lower interest rates. Just wondering how you're sort of thinking about, as interest rates rise, how the household sector and in particular first-home buyers will be able to handle that adjustment.
I think most borrowers understood that the setting of monetary policy that we've had in place over the course of this year was very unusual. And certainly most lenders understood that. So while there'll always be some people who make incorrect assumptions about the level of interest rates, I think most people in the community understood that we were in a very unusual period. And as interest rates rise, I think most people have probably factored that into their budget calculations. So we're not expecting that to cause significant difficulties. I think one of the remarkable things about the Australian mortgage market is just how low arrears have been over a long period of time. Australian lenders, by and large, have been very prudent in making housing loans. We have not seen the type of problems we've seen in the US. We haven't seen the very marked reduction in credit standards that we've seen in the US and some other countries. By and large, the Australian lenders have been very careful, and I think that they've continued to do that, and most borrowers understand that the current level of interest rates, or the rate we've had just recently, is not likely to be sustained. I think have planned appropriately for that.
Hello. Jeff Weinstock, the Australian Financial Review. Just talking about Asia, I think in the first part of the decade, Asia was seen as a force for global deflation, and we're getting cheap goods from China. I'm wondering if growth stays strong in Asia, if you'll start to see Asian growth become a force for exporting global inflation, and if you see that as a concern for Australia.
I don't see that a particular concern for us. I mean, ultimately, we have a floating exchange rate, so we choose what inflation rate we're going to average over time, and I think we'll continue to do that. If the Asian economies recover, then they will, as we have started to do, they will need to withdraw some of the stimulus that's in place. But that's still some way down the track. So I think the short answer is that ultimately we determine the rate of inflation that Australia has. And our objective is to make sure that over time the rate of inflation in Australia averages some number between 2 and 3. And we have done that, and we will continue to do that, regardless of the international environment.
Hi, Phil. I was wondering, can the RBA comment as to why inflation's been so sticky in the last 12 to 18 months, given this global deflation that we hear about?
Yeah, I mean, inflation's always quite a sticky process, but we are starting to see it come down. And the clearest evidence of that, I think, is in the labour market, where wage growth has slowed quite a lot. And in our liaison, we've heard a lot of stories over the past year of firms having wage freezes. And then I think they are now starting to flow through into the CPI. So we are seeing inflation come down. But there's always a lag between the slowing of the economy, slowing of wage growth, then slowing of inflation. And what we're seeing this time is no different to what we've seen on previous occasions. Inflation hasn't been more sticky than we thought it would be. It's unlike the real economy, where our forecasts have changed quite a lot. Our forecasts for inflation have not changed that much. Things have pretty much performed as we had thought. Globally, you're also seeing a gradual reduction in inflation as well as the excess capacity works its way through. And in most countries, what's happening is pretty much as what one would have thought would have happened given the slow growth in output.
I was wondering if the RBA sees the volatility in retirement savings pools as something that might require public policy in the near future.
Well, I have to say, you'll be on my area of expertise here, so I'd rather not comment on that. I don't think I could say anything useful for you. Sorry.
I'll try the same question from a slightly different tack. Do you think that the concentration of household wealth in houses represents a structural instability to the Australian economy over the medium term?
No, I don't. We have high house prices in Australia relative to our income. So a lot of our wealth is tied up in housing. A lot of our measured wealth is tied up in housing. And a lot of people puzzle over whether that's a good thing or not. I think there are some structural reasons why we have high house prices relative to our incomes. But there are also some impediments on the supply side, which I think are very important that we address. As I said, with the population growing at the current rate, we need to build more houses than we're currently doing. And what's happening at the moment is that the average number of people who are living in each dwelling is rising. We've reversed a multi-decade trend of fewer people in each household. And we're having larger household sizes, more people in each house, because we're not building enough dwellings. And I think that is a major issue that we're going to have to confront over the years ahead, because if we're not going to have continuing rising household sizes, which I think is not what the community wants, then we need to find more resources to build more houses. Otherwise, the prices just rise to essentially force people to economise on housing. And I'd have to say, I don't think that's a desirable thing to happen. So one of the challenges we face, I think, as a country, and it's a very important challenge, is how to build the housing that this rapidly growing population needs. And there are clearly things on the supply side there that need really looking at once again. If we can't do that, when we're going to continue to live with, I think, very high house prices relative to our incomes, so a lot of our measured wealth tied up in housing, and I think you can make the case that that's not the best situation to be in.
Thank you.